From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Barbara Slavin, Acting Director of the Future of Iran Initiative and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Joining me on the show this week are David Rennie, Washington bureau chief and Lexington columnist for The Economist, and Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington, D.C. And here are the issues. Donald J. Trump is inaugurated as the 45th president of the United States after a divisive campaign and a transition that raised new questions about whether the country can reunite behind the new president. Leaving office, Barack Obama issued a stream of pardons and commutations, including a decision to give early release to Chelsea Manning, the former U.S. soldier who gave thousands of U.S. government documents about the Iraq War and other sensitive matters to WikiLeaks. Finally, British Prime Minister Theresa May unveiled her plan for a hard Brexit, saying that her country would leave the European Union's single market and end automatic freedom of movement between remaining members of the EU and Britain. Michael, let's start with the inauguration and the mood in Washington. I've been in this town now for more than 25 years, and I have to say that it is a different sort of feeling than what I've experienced in the past. Lots more security, lots more tension in the air.
Yeah, but there's a mood that comes from a recognition now of the very different type of person we've elected to be the head of this country, and it's produced a very different type of mood. This transition has been not anything like I've seen before. I'm a native Washingtonian. I've watched all of these things. Physically, it's different when you look around the city and see the additional security. It looks more like people are being not welcomed, but more kept out. We've seen more of a welcoming, celebratory spirit, and now it's more of a sort of impending doom or something like that. It's a very odd feeling here. But with the president-elect, we see that, he's a man who has come through this transition period and has really caused a lot of angst and a lot of tension. He's taken the bully pulpit and really been quite the bully, in that particular role, rather than Obama, who's been the great healer and the great conciliator.
Or tried to be.
Yeah. Certainly. Yeah. A man of, possessed of a certain type of natural dignity and composure. You see Donald Trump, the brawler, and attacking everyone from civil rights activists to Academy Award-winning actresses. And look, he's coming into the role as the leader of the free world. And it remains to be seen whether that position can change a man for the better. We know it can change a person, but can it change him for the better? That's what we're going to see now for the next 4 years.
Yeah. David, as Michael has pointed out, the changes that one would normally expect after somebody has been elected president have not occurred. Every morning, Donald Trump is still on Twitter. He is attacking people who attack him. He is talking about extraneous matters. The transition itself, there will be fewer cabinet secretaries in place as he takes office than in the past. There are no people in the lower levels. There was a statistic I saw that Trump team has nominated only 28 of the 690 federal government positions that require Senate confirmation. How are we to view him coming in this way? I mean, things seem still very chaotic and scattershot.
I think there's a benign and there's a less benign explanation. So if you are a Donald Trump supporter, you say to people like us who live and work in Washington, D.C., get a grip. What didn't you understand about his campaign? He was an outsider. He promised to be someone who wasn't a politician. Most people outside Washington, D.C. hate Washington, D.C. So the fact that Washington, D.C. is sulking and is unhappy to them means he must be doing something right. And, they don't say, he's upsetting the federal bureaucracy because he hasn't filled all these posts on time. They say he's meant to come in and kick the federal bureaucracy, into the corner and basically close down half
the government. Well, you need people to do that, though.
But the point is that he was elected on a promise to blow the system up, essentially. The odd dynamic about Washington, D.C. is it's not just the most powerful country in the world's federal capital. It's a company town.
Sure.
I mean, we could be making chocolate bars here, we could be making, motor tires here, but it's a company town. And so there's an awful lot of permanent sort of Washingtonians who are clearly very unhappy because Donald Trump has just mounted a hostile takeover of our company. There is, I think, a more alarming explanation for the fact that you're right, that a lot of these posts have not been filled. I was at a party at the British Embassy for the inauguration. It was full of Trump transition people. And there were some really interesting conversations about the fact that normally the most ambitious Republicans would be trying to get into the White House to get as close as they could to the president, because that's where the power is. So if you're a foreign policy Republican, you'd be trying to get into the National Security Council, that kind of the president's very own kind of miniature foreign ministry inside the White House machinery. They're really struggling to fill those jobs because a lot of people are quite anxious that the White House and the National Security Council will be a kind of snake pit of feuding factions and sort of dysfunction.
Sure.
And so people are instead heading to the State Department or to the Department of Defense. And so there is a sense that outside Washington, people probably quite like the fact that Washington's unhappy. But inside Washington, there are some sort of sharp, smart Republican voices saying there's a weird kind of vacuum in the very middle, near the White House, near the president, that people are scared to get too close to that.
Interesting. Michael, is that partly because of Mike Flynn, the National Security Advisor, who is controversial? Is it also because there are a number of very prominent Republican foreign policy experts who signed so-called Never Trump letters during the campaign when it didn't look as though Donald Trump was going to get the nomination, let alone win the election? And many of these people are very respected mainstream types. And so maybe they're having difficulty filling out the jobs because apparently anybody who signed one of those letters, you know, is barred.
It's sort of persona non grata.
Because of revenge on the part of the Trump people.
Yeah, I think at this point, lacking a certain level of expertise and experience, what he's going to rely on is trusting the people that are near him. And if you don't have his trust, if all you have to offer is expertise, and that expertise and experience leads you to a different opinion, you may not be able to find your way to the inside. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's not only the NSC, you know, you have the whole intelligence apparatus now that is at loggerheads with the president in a way that I have never seen before. I have never, ever seen this type of open conflict and in disagreement within them. It seems to me, as you look at the transition, that the adults, as Dave says, are not in the White House. They're across the river at defense with General Mattis. So this daylight that's becoming more apparent between the president and his chief advisors, you know, leads you to believe that, yes, there could be a lot of conflict. And we'll see who actually lasts 2 years from these appointments, who's going to get the you're fired thing, you know, at that point for not agreeing.
True. That's true. He's not one who not to fire someone if he doesn't feel that he's
absolutely
serving. Michael, you touched on something, and that is the disagreements among the Trump people. There certainly is no one vision on foreign policy. David, if you've been listening to the hearings of the various cabinet nominees, big differences over Russia and NATO in particular.
That's right. I think Russia is the real standout, because on some of the sort of big issues, like, say, will President Trump tear up the Iran nuclear deal, he's kind of been on both sides of that, you know, so we don't actually really know where he stands. We don't know for sure whether he plans to walk out of the multi-nation, 190-nation climate change deal signed in Paris in 2016. He's been on both sides of that. You know, he said he would cancel it. He's then said that he's got an open mind. But Russia is amazingly consistent, and you have to assume that he actually is sincere about this, because if you go back to the 1980s, he's been talking this way. He likes strongmen. He likes authoritarians. He has no interest in, you know, human rights and things like that. And so he thinks that Putin is a strong man that he can do business with. And you can see that that is such a kind of challenge to conventional conservative thinking about the world that you saw that as your right when the confirmation hearings happened. Even his nominee for Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, who going into those hearings was kind of being painted as this crony for Russia because as the head of the very large oil company ExxonMobil, he did a lot of business with Russia.
He got a friendship medal
by Russia. You know, actually, once you hear his kind of core geopolitical views, he's, you know, he's pretty skeptical that Russia is, you know, he doesn't say they're nice people or good and trustworthy people. He's just, you know, done a lot of business with them. So that is a real mystery. I think there's also a lot of confusion on his economic policy. I think that actually before we see big dramatic breaks with foreign policy, I think that the first wave of activity is going to be around free trade and picking fights with trade partners like Mexico or China. And there, you know, you talk to diplomats around town whose job is to try and work out what's about to happen. And they meet the people at the top of the Trump economic team and they get a completely different message depending on who they meet with. So there's a lot of anxiety that nobody really knows what's going to happen because the only person who really counts is Donald Trump. And it slightly depends who he last talked to, what he says.
Yeah. I guess the hearings also, Michael, have shown us some interesting differences among Trump nominees for some of the domestic positions as well. And I think we should take note of Betsy DeVos, education, Rick Perry, energy secretary, former Texas governor apparently didn't realize that the Energy Department also deals with nuclear weapons, that it's not just a post for promoting oil and natural gas. I'd love your reflections on some of these other cabinet nominees.
Yeah, you mentioned, too, that we've spoken about that gets particular attention. I mean, Betsy DeVos, in her testimony, really showed a lot of passion for the education issue, but not a lot of knowledge, quite frankly, about the education, not a depth of knowledge that you would expect from someone who's going to be setting policy and directing policy for the education of the United States citizens. Bernie Sanders exposed that very well. A number of senators, through their testimony, to their credit, did some very excellent probing and questioning to expose the weaknesses of these people. I think that she needed more time to prepare.
She didn't appear to even be familiar with what the department did in terms of higher education or federal law regarding people with disabilities in schools.
Act. I mean, not knowing some
basic,
of these
basic homework.
Very basic things. And again, with Rick Perry, I mean, it's almost, I mean, you can call it a little bit comic to say that he would think that the role of Secretary of Energy is being an ambassador for the oil industry. And some people have also joked, well, that's the job of the Secretary of State now. But the fact is that you have to have people who are skilled, educated, experienced, and at least prepared to go to their hearings when you do this thing. I see what the strategy was to pile all the hearings out and, okay, the media can only cover so much at once and maybe we'll slip one by them, you know, or slip a couple by them. But I think that the performances that I saw so far range from underwhelming to embarrassing.
Yeah. And, well, let's say one word, though. I don't know if you, David, if you heard Nikki Haley, the UN ambassador, she actually seemed to be familiar with what the UN does, down to peacekeeping programs and knowing the difference between successful ones and failing ones.
Yeah, and I must admit, I'm slightly anxious about the idea that we can kind of mock these people coming in for not knowing the jargon or not knowing the sort of the exact portfolio of their department. You know, that is shocking on one level, but it's also their democratic mandate. They were elected by a country that doesn't give a damn about jargon and that doesn't like these departments. And many conservatives would like their departments closed down and abolished. So they have a mandate for this stuff. I mean, it's not just that the people who understand these departments need to be careful about saying, oh, well, you don't know what, you know, Division 3B does, you know, what a fool you are. Because people like that, they lost. There was an election and there was a candidate, Hillary Clinton, who can tell you what every bit of the federal government does.
Right.
And people didn't want that. They wanted something else. And what they wanted is what they're getting, which is people who want to blow it up. And that's a democratic mandate. Now, The Economist News magazine, you know, we're very worried by some of the policies that they are likely to advance because we think they will not have the effects that they claim. But the fact they don't know their stuff, that's what people wanted. That's what people consciously chose.
I'm not sure you're right that that's what they consciously chose, but we will see. We'll have more in just a minute. First, a reminder that you're listening to Issues in the News coming to you on the Voice of America in Washington. I'm your moderator, Barbara Slavin of El Monitor, and joining me today are Michael Williams of CBS Radio and David Rennie of The Economist. And this is a reminder that you can listen to Issues online as a podcast. The program is also available for free download on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. Michael, I want to turn to our ex-president, Barack Obama. On the way out the door, he has done a number of things. I mean, he's given speeches, he's given press conferences and interviews and so on, but he's also pardoned or commuted the sentences of a lot of people. And big attention these last few days on several of them, among them Chelsea Manning. Why was that a controversial move?
Formerly Bradley Manning, was a soldier who was a low-level official who had a lot of clearance and divulged a lot of classified information that was eventually turned over to WikiLeaks. So, and she received a sentence of 35 years. 35 years. And this sentence was commuted to the, I think, 7 or so that is served now. And she will be released in 2017, sort of mid-2017. The controversy is pretty clear, I think, on both sides, you know, whether this is a traitor or a whistleblower. Quite frankly, it's pretty clear to say to the military and intelligence complex, here is someone who was given access to secrets and shared them. That is against the law. You have a prison sentence and you should serve it to its full extent. And this is a deterrent to people doing that. The other side says that here's a whistleblower who gave valuable information that opened up and shed light on our democracy, which is something that sorely needs to be done, and that there need to be more whistleblower protections and things like this. Barack Obama listened to both sides and felt that, as is his nature, look, where is justice in this thing? He's constantly searching for justice and to balance
scale.
Yeah. And he said in his exit press conference that he felt that justice had been served, that mm-hmm. the sentence fit the crime, and that there still was a deterrent to further episodes of this. So again, whether that's true or not, you know, remains to be seen. There is no yes or no in this thing, I don't think. I don't see a clear, is he right, is he not? But I do applaud mm-hmm. the president for constantly, you know, as is his way, seeking justice in the matter.
Mm-hmm. David, I mean, there is some extraordinary circumstances. Chelsea Manning is seeking sex surgery and was in a federal penitentiary in Leavenworth for men, tried to commit suicide a couple of times, obviously went through incredible distress. Chelsea Manning also admitted what she had done, expressed remorse and so on. So, I mean, there were some special factors here that could...
You don't get released from prison early because you're unhappy in prison. I mean, I think that was a very weak argument that people were making. I mean, plenty of people don't like being in prison. I mean, you know, that's what prison's for. It's very complicated because, you know, there was an element of what Private Manning did, which was to release some film of an American airstrike that killed some journalists that the military had covered up.
Yeah.
And so that was a kind of whistleblowing. The problem was that, you know, this was someone who released just everything that he had access to, she had access to as a soldier. And she had, I mean, because of very weak security, she had access to ridiculous amounts of data. Mm-hmm. And so basically the entire internal kind of secret communications of America's diplomatic machine were
250,000 diplomatic
and
cables.
And it did
yeah.
real damage. People's lives were really in danger. The American government had to scramble very fast to get some people out who'd been helping them. They had to move them, give them different identities, try and save their lives. You know, she put a lot of people's lives in danger. And she's also made it harder to be an American diplomat because as a result of those cables, people saw, you know, exactly what the American embassy was saying behind their backs, mm-hmm. their contacts with foreign governments. It is now harder to be an American diplomat and do your job properly because people no longer trust that this stuff will stay secret. People tell them less now. Mm-hmm. People say less in writing. People put less in cables. This is a gigantic blow to American power. And I think I know that people inside the intelligence and military machine are disgusted by this.
Yeah.
And they don't think that 7 years is a deterrent, and they don't understand why Barack Obama took this decision.
Yeah. Michael, this whole incident also brought us Julian Assange, right?
Yeah.
This is what made Julian Assange the head of WikiLeaks, the figure that he became. And, of course, we've seen what's happened in terms of interference now in our own elections. So I suppose one could draw a line there. You mentioned the sort of question, is Private Manning a whistleblower or a traitor? A lot of people were comparing this whole case to Edward Snowden. And this was also raised, why Chelsea Manning has a sentence commuted, but there's no pardon for Edward Snowden.
I think you hit on it in the sense that there was a lot of remorse that was expressed. And
people, and no one died as a result, as far as we know. Yeah.
A lot of the rationale for this coming from the White House was that there was remorse mm-hmm. on the part of the perpetrator and that with the physical consequences, the loss of life was little or none. And that's, as you say, David, in large part due to the great work that was done by the intelligence community to keep people out of harm's
way. It also wasn't a pardon, we should be clear. I mean, there's no
a commutation.
It was a commutation.
So basically, you know, the idea was she served 7 years in prison. That's a reasonable prison sentence. And I think the difference with Edward Snowden is that Edward Snowden has not been willing to come back and have his day in court and face charges and go to jail. I mean, so there can't be a pardon for someone who's not willing to come back and face charges.
Also, I mean, it's interesting given that the Obama administration has been much more aggressive in prosecuting leaks to the media, frankly, than previous presidents, which is interesting. One of the people that was pardoned was James Cartwright, who's a retired Marine general and former vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who lied to the FBI about talking to journalists about Stuxnet, the computer virus that was used to infect Iran's nuclear program and set back Iran's nuclear program. And Cartwright, apparently, at least according to the reporters that he spoke to, did not leak the existence of the program, but simply sought to give some guidance about it to make sure that the reporters would do less damage in what they wrote about it. Do you think that was an appropriate pardon?
Yeah, I think that's more appropriate in a sense, because the reporting, if it's accurate, is that he was not charged with leaking information about this incredibly secret program. He was actually told to go and talk to the authorities knew that he was talking to these reporters. It was that he then panicked, in a sense, and lied to the FBI about the exact conversations he'd had with them. And so that was the charge, was that he lied to federal agents. Again, I have to say, I mean, it's true that Michael said earlier, and it's absolutely true, that there's a lot of unhappiness at the top of the intelligence machinery and the military with the insults that they've had from, you know, Donald Trump comparing intelligence chiefs to Nazi Germany. You go lower down, And actually, there's a lot of real detestation for Barack Obama in the military and in, you know, the military voted overwhelmingly for Donald Trump. You know, the rank and file. I mean, overwhelmingly. And they loathe Hillary Clinton and they loathe Barack Obama and they think he's hollowed out the military and that he's not had their back. Plenty of rank and file CIA agents are very unkeen on Barack Obama's record, think that he was weak on Russia, weak on China, didn't have their back on some of the torture stuff they inherited. So it's complicated. There are quite a lot of people lower down, certainly in the FBI, who are really happy that Donald Trump is coming in. So it's not cut and dried. There's a gap between the political chiefs and the rank and file, I think.
Yeah. Well, we will see what happens at the intelligence agencies as the Trump people come in. Michael, I wanted to turn to some foreign news as well, and I'll bring David in on it. But we have now this phenomenon, and it was kind of the canary in the coal mine. The British people voted to leave the European Union. And then we had our own election, which full of populism and nationalism and so on. Donald Trump seems to be very happy about the fact that Britain is going to leave the European Union. What's your sense of the plans that were announced? And I'll ask David to come in as well for a hard Brexit.
Yeah. I'll just set the table for you, David.
Okay. We'll let David do the details.
The speech that she gave a couple of days ago declares that she really wants to make, as you say, a hard break, sort of cutting off all connection with the UK to all the institutions of Europe that have to do with tariff, exchange of goods, free moving of people. And at the same time, she's saying that we're going to set up individual relationships and agreements with the European Union and the common markets that will get us the best of everything without any of the responsibilities of the free movement of people and goods and responsibilities of the other things. And my response to that, my thought on that is that, well, if that was something that was possible, everybody would be doing it. And I just don't think that it's really reasonable or rational to think that that's a possibility. It just doesn't seem that way. But what it really points out to me is that, you know, this thing at its core issue seems to be more and more just about that immigration thing. We sat here a year ago, David, and talked about immigration being maybe the thin edge of the wedge that could break up the European Union, while also saying that, yeah, probably UK will stay in the Union. But look at where we are right now.
Yeah.
And it seems as though that issue about maintaining a kind of cultural purity is worth it at all costs for the UK. And maybe that's a feeling that's spreading across Europe.
David, tell us what you can about the details of the policies that May is going to put in place and whether you think they'll work.
So Michael is right to use the phrase at all costs. So essentially, the confusion since Britain voted to leave was that the promise made to British voters was that they could have their cake and eat it, that they could have all of the access they wanted to the border-free single market for goods and services of Europe, but they could close the borders to immigration. And plenty of people on the other side of the debate, including The Economist, said, actually, you're going to have to choose. If you really want to close your borders and have control of foreigners who come in, you are going to lose that guaranteed free, smooth access to those markets. And that's going to cost you. What's really interesting is that Theresa May has taken the pulse of the British people, and as Prime Minister, she's decided that they put a higher priority on closing the borders to immigration than they do to guaranteed prosperity. So they're willing to take a financial hit and walk out of the single market. Now, she's saying that they'll still get a fantastic sort of terms of access as a friendly neighbour, but she is willing to take that risk that there will be no deal at all, that it'll just be a neighbour rather than a kind of an associate member. I think there's a really interesting gap, though, between Donald Trump's glee and Theresa May's kind of position. So the thing that we're seeing with Donald Trump and the people around him is that they think that Brexit and Donald Trump's election is part of a kind of glorious return of nationalism and identity-based kind of sovereign nations. And they despise the European Union just as they despise the United Nations. They despise globalization, globalism. They talk about nationalism as a good thing. There are people close to Donald Trump who have told foreign governments that they think it'd be good if Marine Le Pen, the far-right leader, won the election in France, that if Angela Merkel lost the election in Germany, that'd be a good thing. Donald Trump's been very scathing about Angela Merkel, the German Chancellor. That is not where Theresa May, the British Prime Minister, wants to be. She needs those European governments to do a good deal. She does not want to fall out with Angela Merkel. Britain is slightly friendless right now. Certainly wants to be very good friends with America, is certainly very keen to show that they can do a trade deal with Donald Trump and America, but they do not want to choose Donald Trump over Europe.
Can they do a trade deal with America until they figure out their relationship with the EU?
No, it's nonsense. So the argument in London is, hooray, hooray, Donald Trump has told us we can have a trade deal really, really soon. Until Britain can tell any foreign country the terms of trade with the gigantic European market next door, there's really not that much to discuss.
I'm afraid that's all the time we have. Joining us today were David Rennie, Washington Bureau Chief and Lexington Columnist for The Economist, and Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineers were Justin Thwaites and Linus Rimkus. I'm Barbara Slavin, Acting Director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council and Washington correspondent for Al Monitor. Thanks for listening.
On this special